Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 123. Speak and Destroy is the first podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Nico Perino, Executive Vice President for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and host of Fire So to Speak, the Free Speech Podcast. Before his writing appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Politico, USA Today, and The Guardian, Nico's first byline was in the Metallica fan club magazine So What. He was a full-fledged member of the Met Club and even won a contest. Nico started listening to Metallica at age 10, spent his teenage years playing guitar in a Chicago metal band, and now devotes his life to fighting for the same issues addressed in Metallica songs like Eye of the Beholder. Nico co-directed the documentary Mighty Ira, A Civil Liberties Story, a feature-length film about the life and career of former ACLU executive director Ira Glasser, and worked as a creative consultant on Can We Take a Joke, 2015 documentary about censorship and stand-up comedy. In this conversation, Nico and I talked about the Metallica catalog, Iced Earth, In Flames, Trivium, Christopher Hitchens, his work with the Fire Org, and why we fight for the free speech rights of those who would see our own free speech rights taken away. Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to partner with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression and Spin Magazine for an interview series called Free Speech and Other Dirty Words. I sat down for an in-depth conversation with Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine and another with Melissa Etheridge. You can find both of those on the Fire Org's YouTube channel. And you can keep up with me at ryanjdowney.com. Keep up with the podcast at speakanddestroy.com. So here it is, my conversation with Nico Perino of Fire. This is Speak and Destroy.
I started listening to Metallica when I was maybe like 10 years old, and wow. I'd be on the playground. Yeah. And I'd be on, I gave my parents like nightmares. I would be on the playground as a fifth grader wearing my Ride the Lightning t-shirt. And they're like, who is this kid that we raised wearing black band t-shirts with the chain, the wallet chain, you know, how those used to be popular. And I think some people still wear them. But like in my era of listening to Metallica, Load and Reload were like thought of as terrible albums. Like I didn't even listen to them. I think there's sort of like a rediscovery of those as actually having some really great tracks on them. But I stopped listening to Metallica after Saint Anger because I couldn't stand that snare drum. And I know that's like a meme now, but you know, I was like, what is going on? This is not the Metallica of Master of Puppets and Ride the Lightning and I've lost touch with the world, the Metallica world, in a certain respect. So I don't know how the community thinks about these things.
It's definitely an interesting and forever evolving and fluid conversation. I mean, for me personally, I think the 30,000 foot view of it that I try to keep in mind is, you know, we each have our entry points with Metallica or bands like Metallica where a lot of it has to do with the time, place, and circumstance of who we are, what was happening in our lives at the given point that we discovered the band, right? Or when you discovered a certain filmmaker or a franchise, you know, where, for example, if you liken it to the Star Wars franchise, I mean, I'm of the age where I saw the first Star Wars as a toddler in the back of the family station wagon and was, you know, in elementary school, the Return of the Jedi was coming out. And yet there are generations of people who are adults now who grew up on the prequels,
So for everyone of, you know, Generation X and the boomers before that, who were viciously angry and upset about the Star Wars prequels, there's a whole generation after that where, like, that's their Star Wars, you know, and they're amped when they hear that, you know, Hayden Christensen is going to be playing Vader in the Obi-Wan TV series. That's like a nostalgic trip for them, in the way that seeing Harrison Ford as Han Solo in the sequel trilogy might be a nostalgia trip for different generations. And I think Metallica is very similar in that I'm of the right age and started listening to the band when I discovered Metallica. The Garage Days EP was the current release.
Yeah, so the EP with all the covers, right?
Yeah, so Cliff Burton had passed away the year before I discovered the band. So Jason Newsted was always my bass player for Metallica growing up. As much as I revered Cliff and understood how important he was and was, you know, checked out the Cliff Hamall VHS and all of that, that was just the era where I came in. So I was of an age also that when the Black Album came out, my little group of friends in high school, where we were all into metal and stuff, by the time the Black Album had arrived, a lot of my friends had gotten into hardcore and punk and sort of looked at any kind of metal as passé or something for, you know, older people. Or the other segment of my metal friends had discovered death metal. And this was around the same time that, like, Morbid Angel and Deicide and Obituary and bands like that were putting out kind of their formative seminal records. And Metallica was weak to people who were getting into the burgeoning death metal scene. And so I remember the Black Album being this pivot point of, like, oh, they sold out. Oh, they're all over MTV. The songs are slower or whatever. But then you study the history of it. And this is what I mean about the 30,000 foot view. There were people who felt like Kill 'Em All wasn't as aggressive or fast as the No Life to Leather demo. And then there were people who, when Ride the Lightning came out, were upset that it had a ballad on it. Like, well, there's a ballad in Metallica? They don't do ballads. They're the speed metal, thrash metal kings. What's this ballad crap? And or a song like Escape was maybe thought of as a little too melodic or poppy, air quotes. And then eventually Ride the Lightning gets picked up by Elektra. And now all of a sudden it's like Metallica are our underground thrash heroes, are on a major label. What the? And then you have fans, you know, after that who were like, the band was over for me when Cliff passed. And Injustice for All is cold and distant, and there's no bass, and it's you know, so it's like every step of the way. And this isn't to dismiss anybody's concern or kind of subjective experience with each era of Metallica, but I do think it's important to note that every step of the way there has been some, as much as they've constantly continued to grow and expand, there's been some contingent of the existing fan base that's gone, oh, this isn't my Metallica. Yeah. I like everything up to here, but not after this, you know? And so I understand that, but at the same time, I also have this perspective on it where, you know, with a few exceptions, like, you know, the Ramones, Motorhead, AC/DC, like, there are some bands who do a variation on a theme every record. And that's part of what we love about them, right? It's like a reliable, there's a new AC/DC record, we know what it's going to sound like. But I think Metallica exists in that stratosphere of bands that they're still artists first and foremost. And they're, ethos has always been what pleases us, you know, what do we want to make, and oftentimes what pleases them challenges their existing audience. And I always find that exciting, you know. And so so I remember a lot of fans, to really answer your question, who dipped out in the Load Reload era. I was a bit of a champion for Metallica in that era of the 90s, again in my friend group, where people are, you know, they cut their hair, they're wearing makeup and this and that and all those sort of complaints. I think Load and Reload have some of my favorite Metallica songs on it. The Outlaw Torn.
Bleeding. I was going to say The Outlaw and Torn might be one of their best songs ever. Yeah,
that's a top 10.
Underrated. They bury it at the end of the album. But I mean, Hero of the Day, Until It Sleeps, you know, King Nothing. These are amazing songs, some of which I don't think got their due until S&M. I don't necessarily feel the same way about Reload. I think that has two really strong tracks, The Memory Remains and Fuel, but, you know.
I think so. I think there's a little more on there too, but it's, but I understand the frustrations. But by the same turn, I would challenge folks who abandoned them in the 90s, maybe, like, go watch their Woodstock 99 performance. That is, like, in my mind, in terms of Metallica, the live band, that's like one of a handful of peaks over the last 40 years, that 99 era, where they're coming out of Garage Inc. and S&M and Load and Reload, and they're just on fire live, the way that they attacked all the material from that era and all of the classic stuff from the 80s. Just unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean, this is a reason I'm really excited to talk with you, because, I mean, a little bit of my backstory. I
want all your backstory.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in love with Metallica, idolizing Metallica. I was 10 years old in 2000, so I'm 33 years old. You know, this was the Load, Reload era. S&M was going to come out a few years later. And me and my friends, we were young, impressionable. Yeah, much like a lot of people, we were kind of influenced by my best friend's bigger brother, of right? Course. Like the stuff he liked is the stuff we liked. And, you know, around that time, you had Mudvayne and Slipknot and kind of the new metal stuff coming out. And we thought of ourselves as like the counterculture to that, right? We missed the guitar solos, Fuel, which feels more a little bit more like a new metal song with stuff we bristled at, but we still loved all the earlier Metallica. Like, we didn't think of the Black Album as a sellout album. It's amazing to think, like, do people, and this is one of the reasons I'm interested in talking to you, do people still, because I'm not in the metal community anymore. I was in a band. We were signed to a local label in Chicago, Rock Chicago Records. We were a death metal band.
We're going to get into all of this. Don't feel like you have to speed through it.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's.
Were you going to ask me, do people still use the phrase
sellout? Yes. Do people still? Because that was very much part of the lexicon, a pejorative word when I was around.
It's funny because it came up literally just before you and I jumped on. I was doing an interview with a singer from a band about a new record he's putting out. And the first song on that record is called Sellout. And it's a song about how different points in his career he felt that he was artistically compromising. So I think the word still gets thrown around, but what's kind of entertaining about it now is that selling out historically was, you know, for punk and hardcore bands, it meant signing to a major label, or it meant editing songs for radio and that sort of thing. And now it's like, you know, you see bands doing all these brand partnerships and I saw this great meme that was like, you know, we stan our Kings when their Chips Ahoy commercial or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's kind of all bets are off in that. And but you do still hear the phrase. And I think that it's always been entertaining for me about Metallica when people have laid that at their doorstep, because I think in their case, selling out for them would be doing things that are safe and predictable and expected. And I think that they are continually uncompromising by taking these left turns that are unexpected and that challenge their audience. I mean, I find Saint Anger to be an incredibly difficult listen. I'm happy that the record exists and that time period.
What do you mean by difficult? Because difficult's like interesting. It's like, it means different things.
Yeah. I mean, you can, I feel like there's songs that, you know, the way Michelangelo would say he sees the slab, he sees the statue of David inside the slab of marble, and he's just going to kind of carve into it. I feel like if Saint Anger was handed to a producer as pre-production demos, there's like a there's a record to carve out of that somewhere. It just never got chiseled away. But there are some songs that they'll play live and I'll go like, well, this is cool. You know, it's got some. Yeah. It's got some moments to it or whatever, but I'm glad that it exists, because they gave us that window into their world with Some Kind of Monster, the documentary film. Yeah. And you yourself as a documentarian, want to get into that also. You can really see that it was a necessary experience for them to go through to make that record. So I can appreciate it from that regard. But I want to back way up prior to even you as a 10-year-old wearing your Ride the Lightning shirt on the playground. What was your earliest experiences with music? Did you have, were your parents playing stuff around the house? Was there music in your life?
Yeah.
Or what was that trip all about?
I like that you asked the question, because as I'm getting older, I'm starting to understand my parents' taste in music a little bit more. Yeah. So, you know, we would drive in the car My dad was one of the earliest adoptees of like XM radio. And, but even before that, he would play CDs in the car and always listen to the same stuff. Elvis, Rod Stewart, stuff that he listened to between like 14 and 22. Yeah. I'm like, this guy doesn't listen to any new music. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
as I get older, I'm having the same experience too. Like the music that I listened to between 14 and 22, unless I'm listening to the radio, I'm not like trying to discover new bands. I'm not trying to discover new music. I still listen, if I'm listening to the metal that I just loved so much in my teen years, I'm listening to In Flames. I'm listening to an old In Flames, like Clayman and whatnot. I'm listening to Soilwork. I'm listening to Children of Bodom. I'm listening to Metallica. I'm listening to Atreyu. I'm only listening to their stuff from that era, right?
It was Alex from Atreyu's who I was talking to right before you and I got.
Oh, were you really? Yeah.
That's funny.
And like, I'm only listening to old Trivium too. Like, I'm only listening to like the stuff where they were still screaming, right? And so I'm starting to understand my parents more too, because I've just seen how naturally I've gravitated when I have the choice to music that I listened to when I was younger.
Yeah.
So, you know, my earliest experience with music was just listening to it with my parents in the car. But my like introduction to metal really came, I think, through a lot of people, just like through my best friend and his older brother, who, you know, when you're young and impressionable, you often look up to. Like, I didn't have an older sibling. I'm the oldest in my family. You know, older people who you think are really cool. And he listened to Metallica. He listened to Korn. He, you know, and he was the one who ultimately introduced me to the sort of Swedish death metal music that I like.
Yeah.
We had this impression when we were young, and this kind of carried over into my band years, which we can get into, that the harder a music is to play, the better it is.
Right, of course. Yeah.
And so that's why we gravitated to death metal, because we were guitar players. And yeah. We were like, the more we can be all over the fretboard, like the harder it is to play, that's the better music. And so that's how we got into that music. And it was kind of an acquired taste. Like I have to admit, I was kind of lying about liking the music early on, because it was what my friend's older brother, who was super cool, was listening to. But then like, as I immersed myself in it, because I wanted to be in this band, that I wanted to break into this band that all my friends were in, like I started loving it. So, and that happened young. I mean, we started listening to this music at like I said, fifth grade. Like Metallica and Iced Earth were like icons to us.
That's so cool. Where did guitar enter into that scenario? How did you get going on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is again my buddy. He lived a couple of blocks down from me, and he was one of those people who you could throw an instrument in front of him and he could listen to a song and he could just play it, piano, guitar. And so he was a prodigy on the guitar. Still is. He's still around. He lives out in Colorado. And I was always super impressed with him. And I, in a certain respect, like idolized him and idolized his brother, who was also a guitar player. And I was like, this is so cool what they're doing. So I want to pick up the guitar. And I never had the natural talent that he did. And my other bandmates from later had. But one of the things I did have was work ethic. Yeah. And so I would just practice. And, you know, I picked it up. Again, didn't come naturally to me, but I still love playing. We just had, you know, you're partnering with us and Spin on that, on the interviews with Tom Morello and Melissa Etheridge. I was just playing a Gibson Les Paul that one of my colleagues who works in marketing has in the office. It was signed by Melissa, right? And I was like, oh, yeah. It's so cool. It was like a $3,000 yeah. Gibson Les Paul. And I don't play guitar as much as I used to.
I watched her sign it.
Yeah, right? It's yeah, a beautiful yeah. guitar. Shit, man, I wish it were mine. But, you know, we idolize rockers for sure.
What comes out of your hands when you put on a guitar right now? What are the riffs that are your go-to just warming up or messing around?
I mean, the pentatonic scales, just like playing some blues, right? Like I still like, again, I don't play as much as I used to, but those scales up and down the fretboard, I just know by heart and I know enough to riff on them. Iced Earth. Those are the riffs that I listened to and learned when I was young. And they're just like, and not just Iced Earth, John Schaefer's partnership with Blind Guardian, Demons and Wizards. I think yeah. that that first Demons and Wizards album is probably my favorite album of all time. It's just banger after banger. If your listeners haven't heard that album, it's called Fiddler on the Green, I believe. It's so good. Some Yngwie stuff, just because I like to impress people. Fretboard. Sure. Yeah, that's what I played for my colleagues who had no idea I played guitar, and they're like, "Holy cow, what's he doing?" So
yeah, oh, that's so cool. Yeah, and I have the Iced Earth has that Indiana tie to me because I grew up in Indiana. I've been in California the last 20 plus years, but and Schaefer lived in Indiana for a long time, and the band was kind of, that was their home base for quite a while. And then
he went to jail, right, for storming the Capitol.
I don't know. I hadn't really heard much about him in recent years.
Yeah, well, I was watching on January 6th, right? So my band buddies, I was just watching the coverage, and I was reading news articles, and there's this like iconic photo, a bunch of people as they're coming into the Capitol, and
yeah,
I know John Schaefer's face from anywhere.
Yeah,
and I'm like, wait, is that
that's Schaefer? Arguably the most famous photo from that day.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, holy cow, there's John Schaefer storming the Capitol.
So. Yeah, it's also one of those like, wow, small world. One of those situations where the various worlds start to cross over. And then you and I spoke, off podcast about In Flames, and you mentioned Clayman. And Clayman was, I was familiar with Horacle, and I had friends who were really into In Flames at the time, but Clayman was the record that really grabbed me and that I really loved. And that was when they started touring in the US a lot. And my band that I was in once upon a time, we actually got to tour with In Flames twice. And our last tour actually, when we broke up, was with In Flames, and it was on Clayman.
Yeah, so, cool.
And it's crazy to think that was, 20 plus years ago, because it was, I think 3 years ago, someone at Nuclear Blast asked me to be in a 20th anniversary of Clayman video that they were making for the band. And I was like, wait, 20 years? And I love that they're still relevant and still putting out records. And that whole new wave of Swedish death metal thing was really exciting to me, because it kind of took the melodic, anthemic side of like an Iron Maiden or an Iced Earth or something, and then combined it with the extremity and the groove of death metal. And that was just brilliant to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was never a big death metal fan on its own. And I think I gravitated toward kind of the Swedish death metal for precisely that reason. It had more melody to it. The choruses were often sung. And at a time when you had a lot of new metal going on, which wasn't always my cup of tea, although I do love a good old Slipknot jam as much as anyone. Those were the bands that were still putting out stuff with the solos, with the intricate guitar work. And then you had some new bands coming onto the scenes too, like Trivium, which was like, the melody there was just fantastic. Like Light to the Flies was a super influential song.
And Trivium very influenced by Metallica, of course.
Sure, yeah. So I remember, it's funny when you think about the clash between kind of older metal with the guitar solos and all that stuff and the new metal. It really came to head to me in 2003 when I saw Metallica in Chicago. And that was the show where Fred Durst, I don't know if people remember this, from Limp Bizkit, was booed off stage because one of the very popular radio station personalities was talking a lot of shit about Fred Durst. And apparently
Man Cow.
Yeah. Man Cow in the Morning. And so you see a bunch of stuff getting thrown at him, booed off stage. That was kind of the end of Fred Durst. I mean, he was like this. And then once he got booed off his stage at the Metallica tour, it was, and then Metallica's like thanking all the other acts, and they say, Limp Bizkit, and then they get booed again. And then the night. But that was like my life, because I also didn't like Fred Durst and Limp Bizkit, because I was rebelling against the new wave, and he represented, and the introduction of rap into metal is just was never my cup of tea. Although I do kind of like Linkin Park.
Yeah. And I mean, there's certainly, whether it's Rage or, I mean, there's certainly rap and rock stuff that's good. I think the issue with Fred Durst, it's funny, I was just having this conversation the other day. For me, it's art is about authenticity. Mm-hmm. So I want to feel like whether it's a film, a book, a painting, an album, I want to feel like the person making it is making it because they have to. Like, this is something they really have to get out. And, you know, I remember when Korn first arrived on the scene, you could look at Jonathan Davis and go, like, this guy means it. You know, he's working something out up there. And to me, someone like a Fred Durst is more of an opportunist, an entrepreneur. And that is certainly a skill set in and of itself, right? And yeah. Networking and making friends and doing all this sort of thing. But I really looked at from the standpoint of just art, I don't feel that's a person who had anything to say. I think it was more about the window dressing, the artifice, the particular sound, maybe the way that sound makes you feel. And again, that's something that works for some people. It's just never worked for me. And I've connected with, you know, artists who are despicable people in their personal lives or with their political views or whatever, but are making things that have meaning for them. And that intention comes across, and I can connect to it in that way. Whereas just, you know, some jock who wants to, you know, sit next to celebrities at the VMAs, that just never connected with me. And again, you know, I mean, some people love the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah, right.
I don't connect with anything about the Black Eyed Peas. It's just, you know, to me, the Limp Bizkit is in that same realm of, like, I get that this is a hook and I get that it's catchy in that sense, but I don't believe this person. I don't feel, I'm not moved by it.
Yeah, I think for me and my peer group, you know, again, elementary, middle schoolers, I was 13 in 2003 when I went to that Metallica show. It was weird to see my dad went into the mosh pit. It's like, it's weird to see, because I need to have an adult chaperone, right? And
yeah,
it's weird to see my dad played in the NFL. He's like 6'6", 320 pounds, and he's in that mosh pit. I'm like, holy cow. And
just taking people out in the pit.
Yeah, right. Like, he couldn't be moved. He was an offensive lineman, so like, I was to not be moved in a certain respect. But like, my friends, because we were young, we would just like, we decided we didn't like nu metal, and so we just would categorically dismiss anyone who fell into those buckets.
Yeah, that's how I was at the same age, but for hair metal, which was really the dominating strand in my generation, and it was the same thing. I've told this on the podcast before, but the first time I saw Metallica, it was Monsters of Rock. They were second of five, and it went Kingdom Come, who was this hair metal band that sounded like Led Zeppelin, Metallica, Dawkins, Scorpions, Van Halen with Sammy Hagar. Yeah. And as an adult, I would love to see the Scorpions. I would love to see a Sammy fronted Van Halen. But at the time, I saw every single band on that bill but Metallica as hair metal. And so my friend and I went, and we stood with our middle fingers up for Kingdom Come. We watched Metallica, and then we went home.
Yeah.
Because it was like, anything Hairspray, teased hair, spandex, songs about chicks, we were just like, nope.
You know, you're more tied in the music community than I am now. And I've always kind of wondered. So I grew up at kind of the tail end of mall culture, where you could kind of identify people by the stores they shopped at, right? You had you had the Hot Topic crew, you had the Vans crew, right? You had the Abercrombie crew. And so, like, you categorically dismissed people based on, like, kind of the group they congregated in. Yeah. And you
also befriended people by the same turn, because you saw somebody in a certain t-shirt or whatever, and you went like, oh, this is my people, we're of the same tribe.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that sort of thing still happens as, you know, mall cultures disappeared. I don't know. Like, I knew who my people were based on where they shopped and the music they listened to.
I think there is still some element to that. It's interesting because, you know, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and she definitely has a friend group where they're all into a lot of similar things and this and that, but it's all digitally driven. It's all they're into certain art and movies and memes and whatever that are, yeah, being shared on Discord and Snapchat. And, you know, and as much as you try to put some guardrails around that stuff, like, that's the culture. I mean, that's teenage culture right now. It's TikTok and,
yeah, I mean, it's a story as old as time, right? It's like, you know, new generations worry about the next generation. Like I said, my parents worried about me wearing Ride the Lightning t-shirts on the playground, and and chains. You know, there was also the time when people would wear like really baggy jeans if they were into metal, like below. And so I remember getting called to the principal's office for that. But you know, that was kind of my crew at the time. I don't know.
And that was your first Metallica show, I assume, right? The Chicago gig.
Yeah, that was a big experience for me. I mean, Metallica was very much a part of my life growing up. I had this walk-in closet in the suburb of Chicago, and I used to use my parents, you know, it was back in the dial-up days, and I used to use my parents' printer to print like just any Metallica picture I could find, and I'd put it on the wall. And I was a member of the Metallica fan club. Does that still exist?
So this is you've inadvertently stepped into a slight bit of controversy.
Oh boy, I didn't know that.
They both simultaneously, I mean, it's hilarious from a marketing perspective because they both expanded the fan club and ended it at the same time, meaning they made this announcement where they said, hey, we're launching this thing called the Fifth Member. You're all the fifth member of Metallica now. Welcome. The fan club is now, there's no barrier to entry. There's no longer a paywall. You're all just in the fan club. So from a glass half full perspective, it was saying like, you know, you're all the fan club. We just expanded it by leaps and bounds. Glass half empty was they were like, well, that fan club that you guys have all been in for years and paying for every year and everything, that's dead. We closed that down. So you have, folks like myself, which they now call legacy fan club members. We still get a little bit of preferential discounts and chances for tickets and stuff like that. They'll throw at the legacy fan club members, but for all intents and purposes, yeah, the fan club is done.
I remember getting the magazines, which were beautifully designed.
So what?
The paper was hard stock. It was really good stuff. And I remember they'd have periodic contests, and I entered into one and won signed S&M poster with, you know,
oh rad.
Jason Newsted's signature is in a different marker because they had to go and get, because he had left the band between I think when I won and when they finally delivered it to me, which I remember was like months, and I was getting pissed that, you know, my poster and my
where's my prize,
yeah, where's my prize. And but I always remember it was just, it seemed like a really well-designed magazine and offered some really
cool incredible work. And they had this guy, Stefan Shirazi, who still works for them, who was a legitimate rock journalist from that world. They basically plucked him from his magazine gigs and just made him, you know, editor-in-chief of So What, became like his gig. I think it still is, because there's still like a digital version of So What that happens. And yeah, I have a binder. It's like a Trapper Keeper that they sold at one point that you could put all the So What magazines in. And I mean, yeah, they're the model for how to treat a fan club. And they did those fan cans. And
yeah, I mean, you might be able to find the essay that I had to submit because they published it.
To win? Oh, that's awesome.
I have to imagine this is like
an early byline. Oh, was that your first published byline?
It probably was.
Yeah.
And maybe revealing too much. I remember I wrote a stupid essay about how I went to Taco Bell and got sick. And it was an endless cycle of eat, sleep, dump. And it was like
heard school death, Metallica, eat, sleep,
dump. Yeah. And it was probably 2001, 2002. I don't know if there are any enterprising listeners, they might be able to find that.
Probably. Yeah.
They might be able to find that. That would be my first byline since I've ventured into more popular publications. But yeah, that would, you're right, be the first byline. But,
So let's talk about the band experience. What was happening for you in terms of, you know, was it, were there aspirations of being a full-time musician? Were you running with, you know, some career stuff in mind and education and everything kind of parallel to doing the band? Or what was your mentality and how far, for lack of a better term, did the band get?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I was in a band called Angel of Fire that was a band within my friend group. I mean, it really started in elementary school. Different members, I wasn't a member of it. And that's one of the reasons I gravitated toward Good Color, because I thought it was super cool that these guys were in the band.
It is super cool.
and it was led by my buddy who I mentioned before, who had the older brother, Matt, and who could just play the guitar as a 10-year-old in a way that most people can if they practice their whole lives. I mean, just a really incredible musician. And at the time, you know, we were really interested in Metallica and Iced Earth. So a lot of our sound was like that. But over the years, and I had entered the band, it gravitated to become more of a kind of Swedish like death metal band. I would say your listeners could maybe check out some tracks, but back when I was in the band, MySpace and Pure Volume, where you went to listen to music, right? And those places have kind of gone belly up. And so if you can't really find it, it's Angel Fire, all one word. And then the band, once I left later, became Phoenix Down. You might be able to find some of those tracks around. But it was populated by a bunch of really talented musicians. And I was good enough. I was rhythm guitar. And I was good enough because I practiced all the time. And the band, because of just, you know, we would play in front of people a lot older than us. The other bands we would play with were like, we were 14 years old, and we would just kind of blow their minds with the musicianship that we had. And I was the guy in charge of marketing and advertising. Like, I always found that stuff interesting. And in the local scene, we would get 150, 200 people out to each show.
You were the Lars, in a sense.
In a sense, yes. And there was this kind of local pseudo record label called Rock Chicago Records, which had made its name by supporting the kind of emo scene in Chicago, which was very big at the time. Like, they had the Academy Is and one of the first, you know, connections with Fall Out Boy, some of these like big, these big bands. And so that they were the, not just like a record label, and that they had artists that were under their umbrella, but they also booked all the shows, and they brought us in. We were a unique fit for them. They didn't really have metal acts, but because we'd bring a lot of people to these shows, right, and would make a lot of money and for the promoter. And so we ended up getting put on you know, a lot of shows, and we'd play shows every weekend in the Chicagoland area. You know, we would play with sometimes bigger acts like 3 Inches of Blood. I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah, dude, of course. Roadrunner.
We were always the young guys. And then ultimately the band started to fall off. I became less enamored in the world of metal, but I had dreams of becoming like, this would be all I do full time. And I definitely had that transgressive rebellious streak that lots of young people have that scared the shit out of my parents. And, but in my senior year of high school, I got interested in politics, political philosophy. I also was pretty good at sports. I ran track and was the team captain for York High School, which is probably the most successful track program in the country. And ended up going to Indiana University to run track. If you would ask me 5 years earlier if I was going to go to college, I'd probably have said, no, I want to be in the band. But things change. And this is one of the things I keep in perspective as a parent now is, you know, this scared the living daylights out of my parents that I was a metalhead at like 10 years old. Yeah. But kids evolve and they change and they find new interests. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a metalhead, much to the contrary, but it's like, it's given me some my evolution has given me some perspective as a parent about what to worry about.
Yeah. I feel 110% the same way, and things that I know that my parents were concerned about. I mean, I can relate 100% to what you just said on every level, and trying to put that same perspective as a parent now and recognizing like, and being also really focusing on the positive things that I see about who my kids are growing into being, you know, where it's like, oh, okay, like they're okay here, they're okay there, like, you know. And
yeah, not, I think, like, my parents missed some of the things that being in this band was teaching me. Like, I managed this band, I promoted this band. If you ask any of my band members, like, I was the one who was organized, and like the life skills that I learned there are crucial to what I do today. How I manage the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression and promote its work. It's like, I learned those lessons there. I also learned the lesson of hard work.
Yeah. And communication. Communication is crucial too. If you're representing a band and you're having to get gigs and negotiate record deals and, you know, deal with interpersonal conflicts and, you know, managing a group of people and all that stuff. Those are all skills.
Oh yeah. There's so many skills, soft skills, but as well as hard skills, like just learning to play guitar and the commitment that that takes to be able to do it at a high level live. And so I think there were just some things that my parents missed that led to their worry because they weren't a part of that world that I'm going to, as a parent now, have to be on the lookout for. Like, okay, I'm worried, but what am I missing here? Right.
Right. Yeah. What am I, my kid wants to play Roblox all night. What might be good about this?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like,
bad, but there's hand eye coordination. There's problem solving skills. There's, things that you might not think about. I'm super fascinated to hear where the fork in the road was for you with politics and being interested in that. For me, I had an older brother, like you're talking about your friend's older sibling, and my older brother passed down, the Sex Pistols and Adam and the Ants and some really, really cool stuff from, that was before my time in terms of like early punk and things like that. And my political activist kind of awakening really was driven by music, because a lot of them, whether it was Dave Mustaine and Megadeth and, songs like Peace Sells and things like that, that were, and also a lot of punk and hardcore and crossover and stuff that I was into, whether it was Jello Biafra and the Dead Kennedys, growing up with a lot of this sort of sensationalized talk shows, some of those folks would, Ice-T, some of these characters would do the talk show circuits, and they would speak very eloquently and articulately about freedom of expression and having a unique point of view. And without going too much of a tangent in this direction, it's been interesting as a Generation X kid and as somebody who was into punk and hardcore and metal and everything and hip hop and the late 80s and early 90s and those really formative periods for those genres and for me as a human, it's been interesting to think that, Satanic Panic and the religious right and the PMRC and all of these things, that it was very much the liberal side, for lack of a better term, that was advocating for the importance of free speech and expression. And in many ways, we've landed at a point in our culture now where a lot of those folks are the new Puritans. A lot of the folks that we would have identified as fighting for free speech are now the ones policing speech and policing expression. And there's a lot of it. I don't want to go too far because there's a lot of both sides isms you can do right now where each end of the spectrum has their.
Their problems for sure.
They want to shut down the expression. Yeah. They want to shut down. Yeah. But having said all that, for me, it was really that a lot of that political punk and some of the thrash bands that would, there was a lot of anxiety about, we all thought in the 80s that nuclear holocaust was imminent, so there was a lot of thrash metal and punk songs about, Age of Quarrel with the mushroom cloud on the cover, and like, sure, we were all waiting for that to happen any second. So for you, what was music part of that? Was it totally separate? What was your...
I mean, it was totally separate, although I think some of the instincts became a part of it later. I mean, I had a teacher, Mr. Torney, my junior year of high school, who was a social studies teacher and introduced us to George Orwell's 1984 and kind of spoke to the libertarian-ish instincts that were always kind of in me. He wasn't like trying to indoctrinate us or anything, but like he raised good questions. It was during the age of the Iraq War, and we would talk about the Patriot Act in class. And for whatever reason, it was just one of those moments in my life where I just gravitated toward that issue. And I started to become more and more a civil libertarian, and core to that, of course, is free expression and the First Amendment's protection for that. And so I went off to college, and I had a really formative experience where I grew up, because of those interests in the kind of Patriot Act and the Iraq War, really admiring Christopher Hitchens. I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with him, but he's probably one of the thinkers I admire most and writers. He died in 2011 from esophageal cancer.
I just got literal goosebumps. The top five favorite writer of mine of all time, any genre, fiction, nonfiction.
It's cliche to say it. It sucks that he's gone.
It does. And all again, without sidetracking us too much, I once did a 5-hour interview with Christopher Hitchens.
The amount of money that I would scare my wife by be willing to play to spend an hour with him. Would have been. Anyway, I mean his book, way, Letters to a Young Contrarian, it's essential reading for anyone who works in my department here at FIRE.
You'll appreciate this too. The interview I did with him was a few months before 9/11, and it was for a Chicago-based magazine called Punk Planet. Mm-hmm. And by the time I had done the interview and I transcribed everything and was getting an article together, and this is no slight on Dan Sinker, who ran Punk Planet, who I admired a lot and enjoyed working with. But by the time I was ready to turn that in, Christopher Hitchens had made his ideological pivot post 9/11. And all of a sudden Punk Planet said, we don't want your Christopher Hitchens article anymore. And so that it never ran.
Yeah. I mean, what happened to Christopher Hitchens there was, I mean, he was uncancelable, but it was kind of like a cancellation.
Yeah.
And there's this documentary about Christopher Hitchens' life that you can find on YouTube, made by an independent filmmaker who I tried to get in touch with at one point and tried to hire because he just did such a fantastic job, where he talks about his reasoning behind his support for the Iraq War, which I never kind of agreed with him about. But he used original archival footage to kind of narrate Christopher Hitchens' reasoning. And it's one of the most compelling arguments for why America should have gone into that war that I've ever heard. And so if you feel confident in your position on the Iraq War, I urge folks to kind of listen to that as the most articulate argument on the other side.
I need to find that documentary. Yeah.
Yeah. If you just Google it, it's on YouTube, or maybe it's Vimeo or something.
People are often shocked when I talk about Christopher Hitchens being one of my, you know, 5 favorite writers, period, because I'm a believer. And obviously he's very famously known as one of the, you know, 4 horsemen of the new atheism. And it doesn't change the fact that he's one of the most incredible thinkers and writers who's ever lived, certainly that ever lived contemporaneously with me.
And that's how I got introduced to him. I mean, as I mentioned, formative years were when the 4 horsemen were out there writing their books like God Is Not Great and The God Delusion. And that's how I became first interested in Christopher Hitchens. I grew up in an Italian Catholic family. There was one summer where I tried to go to church every day, but then
Irish Catholic over here.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Very similar, I guess. And then I met these guys and sort of gravitated toward the anti-theism that they believed in. I'm no longer, anyway, we could get into that, but I watched Christopher Hitchens' documentary with this evangelical pastor from Idaho, Douglas Wilson.
Yeah.
Collision. Yep. It's one of the best documentaries.
And this is going to, I'm going to small world you right now. Darren Doan, the guy who directed that, is from the hardcore scene. And directed music videos for Hatebreed and AFI. And, you know, and then, yeah, ended up working on that documentary and now makes movies with Kirk Cameron.
Really? I mean, it's a great documentary. I think you can still get it. I don't think you can stream it, but I think you can buy it. And it's Christopher Hitchens traveling the country debating Douglas Wilson. And these are two men who diametrically opposed on the issues, but have this commanding knowledge of scripture. And they just go back and forth. Douglas Wilson will quote one line of scripture, and then Christopher Hitchens will quote another to refute him. And I was like, this is what I want to go to college for. I want to be Christopher Hitchens debating the Douglas Wilsons out there. And then lo and behold, maybe it was 2012, Douglas Wilson comes to Indiana University's campus. This is my opportunity to be Christopher Hitchens. I'm going to go to this. I'm going to sit in the audience, and I'm going to ask these piercing questions of Douglas Wilson, because I was still kind of atheist at the time, and it was a cause that I cared about. But no sooner had the event been announced than you started to see what you see a lot of on college campus now: protests, demands that it be deplatformed, and they were holding up signs, shakers. The event got derailed. I mean, the sort of intellectual debate that I'd seen in Collision was not allowed to occur. And there was this one moment where Douglas Wilson said something that has remained with me ever since and kind of got me interested in doing free speech work, particularly on college campus. He says, I always think I'm right, but I don't think I'm always right. Mm-hmm. And so I went there to teach. I always think I'm right, but I don't think I'm always right. It's this idea that you have strong convictions loosely held, which I think is necessary as a prerequisite when you're attending college. The idea being that new evidence will hopefully change your mind. And I went there to teach Douglas Wilson a lesson, but he ultimately taught me one. And he showed me what illiberalism looks like. It was these people who had strong convictions, strongly held, and whose mind couldn't be changed and couldn't even grapple with opposing ideas. They had decided that because Douglas Wilson's ideas were wrong and retrograde in their mind, that they could make up everyone else's mind as well. And they didn't have to allow those people to listen to him. And since then, on college campuses in particular, and it's breeding into the larger society, you're seeing more calls from students, young people, to censor. And this comes back to music in an interesting way, because when I grew up with music, I loved the music I loved because it was transgressive, because it was rebellious. You know, you listen to Dee Snider and Twisted Sister, we're not going to take it. You know, another brick in the wall, you know, teachers, leave those kids alone. But now it seems like young people are trying to enlist power, get them on their side, not rebel against it. At least the institutions, they're trying to reshape them in their, I worry that if some of the things that animated kind of music during my generation also animated people's perceptions of freedom of speech and liberties, and to the extent music has become a little bit less transgressive, and this could just be the guy over 30 speaking at this point, it's also become a little bit more on the side of those in power, or trying to work with those in power rather than rebel against those as part of the identity. I don't know, maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's not, but it's, you know, it's not how I grew up and how I self-identify.
Something that gets lost in this conversation sometimes as well, I think, is that it's also very infantilizing.
Oh, sure.
This need of, well, we got to keep the bad person from saying the bad things, because it's going to, you know, I am of a strong enough mind to resist, but I need to protect all of these simpletons around me who might be swayed by this. And it's arrogant. It's fear-based, you know, the idea that someone might read something bad and that might change them and make them bad. And it goes back to, yeah, a lot of those same moral panics, you know, the idea that Elvis shaking his hips, or someone putting on a drag show, or someone misgendering someone, you know, go on down the list.
Yeah, Osborne talking things. About suicide solutions and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, like, and it's this, you know, I'm with you 1,000% as a civil libertarian that the reason why it is the first of the amendments, speech and expression is where it all stems from. And I'm much a big believer in the idea that the best way to combat bad ideas is to present better ones. And that can't happen if you're, you know, kind of rigging the game and not allowing a full expression of a different point of view. Because if we're that confident that our convictions are correct, then we should be unafraid to have them challenged. And it's, as you said, that, I mean, that's such a great quote, because for me, you know, to liken it into a faith journey, I've found in more recent years, you know, after a lifetime of a quest for certainty, so to speak, of trying to find definitive answers to life's big questions, that I'm much more comfortable and living a much more satisfying life existing within that mystery. Mm-hmm. And being open to the idea of being persuaded by new information and learning and exchanging ideas with other people. And yeah, the idea of shutting that stuff down. To me, the most dangerous part of shutting down speech and expression is that so many of the things that we take for granted now that were the result of social upheaval and movements and hard-won change are things that would have been, if today's censors had their druthers, that would have been censored in those times, right? Like, you know, when you think about, say, marriage equality, for example, well, there was a time where we wouldn't have allowed any discussion about that, you know?
Yeah.
And so
it's sort of the idea that, it's a political reference, Francis Fukuyama wrote The End of History, which is a famous essay saying that essentially democracy and capitalism won after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But in a certain sense, the would-be censors feel like we've reached the end of history as well, that everything that is good and noble has been discovered, and all we need to do now is close the door. And anyone who is not on the side of the good and the noble at this point, we can just censor because there's no new information that we need to discover. We're so certain that we're right. Yeah. What do we need all this free exchange of ideas for? And, you know, it's also just tactically stupid. You know, sometimes you confront old school libertarians, civil libertarians, or like old school liberals like Bernie Sanders with some of the kind of trends that are percolating within younger progressive circles. Bernie Sanders was asked about some speaker on campus. He's like, why would we censor him? What are we afraid of? His ideas? Like, just debate him, right? It's like, and it just goes to show that the goal isn't necessarily to change people's minds. It's not social change. It's to win through power and coercion, which is what censorship is. I'm far more interested in bringing people along to my side. And even if they disagree with me now, that doesn't mean that they will always disagree with me, right? How do you hope that people's minds are working and that they change when confronted with good evidence?
Yeah. And you would hope that there is something instinctual and basic, and whether you want to call it a classical liberalism or, you know, however we define it, whether it is a Quran, whether it is a Harry Potter book, if, you know, whether you're burning a Harry Potter book because you think it's witchcraft and sorcery that's going to lead people away from Christianity, or whether you're burning it because you think that J.K. Rowling is a monster of epic proportions. If you're burning books, that should be your first clue that you've gone astray.
Yeah.
You're fighting the wrong fight when you're...
No, sometimes I feel like burning books gets all the... Like, that is viewed as morally repugnant and rightly so. But the same instinct that motivates book burning, I feel like, motivates speaker shoutdowns. And you see that far more often. It's like the idea that there are certain ideas that just cannot be expressed. Me, what does it matter if it's written on a page or spoken from a podium? It's the same effect. It's the same instinct. And if you asked, a lot of these people were shouting down speakers, should we burn books? They'd probably say, absolutely not. That's what the Nazis did, yeah. Right? But okay, how is what you're doing any different? You're preventing a willing audience and a willing speaker from interacting with each other because you do not like the ideas the speaker says, and you think, and your all of your paternalism, that the audience isn't equipped enough to handle it and to judge on their own whether the arguments have merit. It's completely infantilizing and against everything that I've ever stood for. And it harkens back to my days in music when, you know, my parents and all the powers would be saying, I can't listen to this heavy metal music because it's, you know, it's going to lead you into juvenile delinquency. I'm like, get out of here. You know, yeah.
It's going to shake whatever's good and pure about you. You know, I sent this tweet recently. I think you might have retweeted it, where I said, I can tell the Fire org does great work because both liberals and conservatives on Twitter get mad at them about fighting for the free speech rights of people with the quote wrong opinions. And within less than an hour, here's two comments I received from two different strangers. One was, this is the most childish opinion on politics that anyone can have. The right gets mad at Fire for opposing massive overreach by Republicans because the right are hypocrites. On the other hand, Fire regularly supports white nationalist far-right orgs like TPUSA. Here's a different stranger within the same hour. Defending the woke authoritarians that are all about destroying free speech for everyone else is a weird position. So yeah. Less than an hour of me saying, you know, people get upset with Fire because they protect the people with the wrong opinions. I had someone from each side of the spectrum pop up and do exactly that.
Welcome to my world, Ryan. This is all I deal with. Every day, right? We are a politically and ideologically diverse organization who defends the Bernie Sanders group at Georgetown, the self-avowed socialist at Joliet Junior College in Chicago, who's detained by police for handing out anti-capitalist flyers. And yes, we defend the TPUSA chapter at Emerson College in Boston, whose group is disbanded and they're prevented from handing out flyers critical of the Chinese government. And, you know, the rights of people who are at the margins of society to invite people like Richard Spencer or Milo Yiannopoulos to campus. We sue Governor DeSantis when he and the legislature pass into law things like the Stop Woke Act, which seeks to prohibit certain categories of speech from being taught in higher education. And we sue the administration at Clovis Community College when they tell a conservative group on campus that they can't pass out flyers critical of communism. Like, this is what we do. And you sort of just accept when you do nonpartisan free speech work that people are going to be selective.
They're really telling on themselves when they are on both sides. Yeah. Of the
spectrum. Yeah. I mean, you get used to this sort of thing, and I don't take it personally anymore. It used to really animate me. Not so much anymore, but our record speaks for itself. And I always say that, you know, if you look at our cases and find that we're only taking cases on one side, you're looking at the wrong record, because that's not our record.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to get into your documentary, because a lot of the stuff we're talking about and the great work that FIRE does, and what's so appealing about it to me, is that it is very much traditionally what the ACLU once upon a time was all about. And I remember one of the first things I ever heard about the ACLU as a kid in my own sort of political awakening was that they fought and defended the right of neo-Nazis to march peaceably in the streets. Yeah. And, you know, one of the ways that that argument will collapse on itself for some folks is they go, well, we're protecting the right of these neo-Nazis to go out there, but if the neo-Nazis have their say, they're going to immediately stamp out everyone else's free speech rights and, you know, and stamp out the lives of a portion of the population. So how can we fight for their right to say things? And this gets to the documentary that you made. And yeah, if you could sort of speak to that, you know, why do we fight for the rights of, or like this guy who said to me, the woke authoritarians, you know, if they had their way, they'd be censoring what we can say. Why fight for the free speech rights of people who don't believe in the free speech rights of others, I guess is the question.
Yeah,
why,
I mean,
why did the ACLU do that? Why do we do that today?
Part of the people who make those arguments have just a lack of faith in humanity, in the system. And if we're going to be on the road to totalitarianism in this country, it's not because we let the Nazis speak. It's because there's something much more sinister going on. You know, they banned Hitler in Bavaria from speaking. And what did Joseph Goebbels do? His propaganda minister turned it around and turned it into a national advertising campaign that said, one man among 2 billion in the world is not allowed to speak in Bavaria. 2 billion people in the world at the time. And it was a political coup. Right. The idea that, you know, what does this man have to say that the authorities are so afraid of? And you have to remember, this is Weimar Germany. There's a lot of distrust in the system. There was hyperinflation, stagflation at the time. As Learned Hand said in a famous 1944 speech during, you know, World War II, he said, liberty lies in the hearts of men. When it dies there, there's no article, there's no constitution, there's no piece of paper that can save it. Right. So you impart, and this is the message of my documentary, Mighty Ira, you impart protect free speech because it's an insurance policy for you. It's what protects your right to speak. You might trust Barack Obama with the speech codes, but none of us are immortal. And the next year you might have Donald Trump who gets to wield those speech codes. And do you feel like he is the angel with whom you can entrust to censor properly? So I made this documentary, Mighty Ira, which is about the life and career of the executive director, the longtime executive director, former director of the ACLU, Ira Glasser. I met Ira Glasser at the funeral for an old school civil libertarian named Nat Hentoff. He comes up to me and he's like, you're Nico Perino. I said, yes, I am. Who are you? And he said, Ira Glasser. I'm like, I had known of the name, but I didn't recognize him. He said, you do what we used to do. Okay, what do you used to do? Oh yeah, you were the guy who led the ACLU. And so I invited him on my podcast, so to speak, the free speech podcast. He said, you know, Nico, I retired in 2001. So at the time it was like 16 years prior. And he's like, I don't know if that I'll remember anything, but I'm happy to come on and talk. And 3 hours later, he's still talking. And he told these vivid stories of how he and his colleagues who grew up during the civil rights movement and saw how free speech protections were essential for defending the rights of civil rights protesters to march. Often they weren't enforced, but at least the civil rights marchers had the First Amendment to fall back on. It actually, if you look at Martin Luther King's last speech in Memphis, where it's famous mountaintop speech, he says that, you know, if I lived in China or Russia or any of these other totalitarian countries, I could understand then the censorship that is being brought upon our civil rights movement. So they at least had that there as a promissory note to fall back on. But Ira Glasser, I mean, to just kind of fast forward a little bit, you know, and his colleagues understood the importance of free speech because they saw how necessary it was for their other social justice movements to advance. And I feel like my generation is forgetting that history. And so I made this movie, Mighty Ira, to tell the history and the story of not just Ira Glasser, but the people of his generation, to remind my generation why freedom of speech is important and the costs that if it's lost. And the through line in the movie is about when the neo-Nazis marched in Skokie, Illinois in 1977, or rallied, I should say, or petitioned a rally in Skokie, Illinois, which was then home to 6,000 Holocaust survivors. And the efforts to censor them had unintended consequences of censoring the Martin Luther King Jr. Coalition in Chicago, the Jewish war veterans in Skokie, and just shows how censorship is a double-edged sword. It can fall on your enemies, but it can also fall on you, depending on who's using it. Ira Glasser likens it to poison gas, right? A very effective weapon when your enemies are in their sights, but the wind has a way of shifting. So you protect free speech for all so that you don't have to worry about which way the wind is blowing.
Amen. And that's a great place to land the plane and wrap up. And Nico, I could talk to you forever, and I look forward to talking to you more about a number of things. But thanks for coming and talking about you, your life, your interests, and, of course, the Mighty Metallica.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So hope to do it again.
I'll make sure to put in the show notes and everything where people can find you and keep up with your great work. And God bless you, and more power to you.